Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, my name is Anna Hepp from Austria, and you're listening to the tennis podcast. Go, Dominic!
Well, hello to Anna Hepp, daughter of Christian Hepp, that you heard in our intro there. She's a particular fan of Dominic Thiem, as you could hear, because Anna and Christian are from Austria. I'm not saying that's the only reason necessarily that they're a fan of Dominic Thiem. Maybe they would be a fan of his, you know, if they were from Timbuktu. But as it is, they've got no choice to be Dominic Thiem fans because they are from Austria. Thank you, Anna, for that wonderfully uplifting intro there, and thank you, Christian, for your support of the tennis podcast, which leads us nicely, I think. Matt chose that intro because he said that's a lovely segue into Vienna, which is the tournament that's just reached its conclusion yesterday on the ATP Tour. We've had a couple of them this week. We're starting with the Paris Masters today. As I speak to you, I'm watching Martin Fucsovics and Borna Coric locked in first set battle at the Paris Masters. But we'll start off with reviewing the goings-on from Vienna last week, seeing as Anna provided us with such a lovely segue. David, you all right with that?
Yeah, that's fine by me. It's just a bit of a blow that Dominic Thiem has pulled out of Paris, really, with his whatever it is, foot injury, is it, Matt? Is that what's happened to him?
Yes, foot injury, which he seemed to sustained during his match against Andrei Rublev in Vienna, and it hampered him in that match. Yes, not a good week to be sort of talking in glowing terms about Dominic Thiem, unfortunately, but he's obviously hopeful for the ATP finals, I think.
He's saving himself for London, Anna. Don't worry. Mm. So, you mentioned Andrei Rublev there. Andrei Rublev, who... Thank you very much, Matt. You reminded me that I predicted a year ago would have a big 2020. I genuinely had forgotten that, so thanks very much. He's won his fifth title of the year. He's only played 12 events. He's qualified now for the ATP Finals. He beat Lorenzo Sonego, and more of him certainly later, 6-4, 6-4 in the Vienna Final. Yeah, he's won 5 of the 12 tournaments he's entered this year. He's won them on hard courts, clay courts and indoors. He hasn't lost to anyone outside the world's top 40. And he's lost only 6 sets in those 5 tournaments that he's won. That information from Enrico Riva on Twitter, who's pumping out some wonderfully useful stats at the moment. Andrei Rublev.
Is he the player of the year so far in the men's tennis?
No.
No.
He's won more titles than anybody else. He's won 5. Djokovic has won 4. Nobody else has got anywhere near.
Yeah,
those things are all true. Those things are true, yes. But I don't think he's the player of the year. I wouldn't put him above Djokovic or Thiem, for example, who've both won a slam and reached another slam final. I think all those stats that you've just laid out for us perfectly sum up what Andrei Rublev has been doing this year. He's found a level of week-in, week-out consistency at the 250 and 500 events that no one else has found, and therefore that's resulted in loads and loads of titles, and I'm incredibly impressed by that endurance and that durability that he's got. Because, as I said, I think during Roland Garros, this is a guy who was injury prone at the start of his career, and I'm just impressed that he's able to keep going and keep finding the motivation and also the physical strength to keep doing what he's doing. But you know, I think there's a level he needs to go up if he's going to be the absolute best player of the year, and that's doing it at Masters 1000 events and at Grand Slams.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think had he had a real breakthrough at Grand Slam level, there would perhaps be more of a conversation around it, David. But he has hit that ceiling at the Slams this year, hasn't he?
He hasn't broken through
his glass ceiling.
What if he wins Paris and then London, now that he's qualified for the ATP Finals? What if he won both of those? Would he be Player of the Year?
It's quite a big hypothetical, isn't it? But yeah, it's certainly worth revisiting the conversation. I'd be surprised if I ended up saying, yes, he's the Player of the Year. But you're welcome to re-raise the conversation in that scenario, David.
Okay? I will. He's one of the most impressive, though, isn't he, this year, given, I think, and I know that you were predicting big things for him, Catherine, this year, and one or two others were as well. Certainly more than I would have been. You know, I thought he could have had a good year. I didn't think he would be doing what he's doing. I really didn't. Particularly when you consider he's done it before and after this six-month hiatus from tennis. I think that's mightily impressive to just keep on backing it up. It shows his appetite. He is so hungry to win and compete. He loves it, doesn't he? He loves the tour. He almost loves it too much for his own good sometimes, I think, physically. And I think that that's probably the sort of issue you were alluding to earlier in his career, Matt, that he got injured a lot and he had serious injuries at times and his body couldn't really cope. But I love the way he just keeps coming back for more.
Yeah, he's currently entered into Sofia qualifying.
Of course he has.
Which I imagine was an insurance in case he hadn't qualified for London. I expect now he has secured his qualification for London that he will be hopefully hastily withdrawing from Sofia, with all respect to that event.
Poor Sofia. Last week we raised their hopes that Nadal might play. Now we're raising their hopes that Rublev might play.
Is that next week, Sofia?
Yes, it's in between Paris and London.
But I do think it's a fine balance for Rublev that how much he plays, because I do think that that hunger you described, David, comes from those injuries that he's had, or certainly the real edge to that hunger. I don't think it would be the same had he not been through that pretty harrowing period at the start of his career where he was watching all these other youngsters surpass him, all these other youngsters who he'd been playing junior finals with for years. So he had to sit on the sidelines for nearly a year after he had had one of the earliest breakthroughs, reaching that, was it a fourth round at the US Open?
Quarterfinals,
yeah, when I did that interview with him and spent the whole thing startled about how deep his voice was. he was kind of the first of those Russians to have the big breakthrough. And then he had to sit and watch them all pass him by, which must have been incredibly hard. And he talked about periods of depression. And it wasn't just one injury. It was a few. So he must have, you know, there are plenty of horror stories. Look at Thanasi Kokkinakis. He was in quite a similar boat to him. There are plenty of real horror stories about players that just never recover from those sorts of injuries early in their careers. So I think that is where the hunger stems from. But he'll need to manage it. He'll need to withdraw from Sofia qualifying, is what he'll need to do.
It's quite interesting that his agent is the same agent who managed the entire career of John McEnroe and continues to manage the career of John McEnroe post-tennis and doing all of his exhibitions and all of his appearances, a guy called Gary Swain, an American guy who works for IMG. And he's been with Rublev since I heard of Rublev for the first time. And I find it quite an interesting association because it's meant McEnroe has been really heavily invested emotionally in Rublev's career himself. And I think Catherine, you would have been on the Champions Tour probably when Rublev was coming along and seeing. I'm pretty sure they practiced a little bit together. They would have hit together McEnroe and Rublev, and you know, I mean. Gary is somebody Catherine and I both get along well with from our dealings with McEnroe. But I mean, you know, his life is stressful dealing with McEnroe all the time, as much as we like John most of the time. But Rublev seems to, I mean, he couldn't be more different, could he? He's a young, seems quite shy, quite earnest, you know, he seems like a nice young lad really. But I like that, the fact that he stayed with the same management company or manager specifically, and I'm very interested watching his development and having come through that period of injury and difficulty, and I wonder what the ceiling is really, you know, because when you look at him in these tournaments, he seems so reliable. It takes a heck of a performance. Sometimes you get Zverev, sometimes you get Tsitsipas. These guys, and I can imagine team as well, when team's playing well, they just got too much firepower for him or too much know-how, you know, but he's catching up. And he's got firepower of his own.
Well, at the Slams this year, he's lost out to Zverev in Australia, round of 16, that was straight sets. He's lost out to Medvedev at the US Open, also straight sets, and Tsitsipas at Roland Garros, straight sets. So that at the moment is the ceiling I'm describing, you know, as detailed by Enrico. He's not lost to anybody outside the world's top 40 this year. He's established a level that he's consistently hitting and having very few blips, but that's not going to be enough for him, for sure. He wants to be making, well, he wants to be winning slams ultimately, but he definitely will be wanting to make a big Grand Slam breakthrough, and soon, I would have thought, very soon.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just looking at the people he beat. I mean, he had a bit of luck getting past Jannik Sinner because Sinner had to withdraw. That was a match I was really looking forward to seeing.
Because they're so
such
similar.
Such a shame.
Sinner didn't work, did it?
Nice try.
I had to give it a go.
And then, of course, team was not really fully fit by the end of that match. I mean, I think the first set was a tie-break set. But then, I mean, I watched the latter part of the second set and team was hobbling around, to be quite honest.
Yeah, how bad do we... I don't want to worry Anna and Christian, but how bad do we think team's foot injury is? Is it a question mark for London?
He was saying no, or in as much as he's concentrating on that and he intends to get well for it. He certainly didn't look right on that court. I mean, I don't think there was any real question mark over him being able to play Paris. I think he might have gotten on the court, but I don't think he could have been competitive in Paris. So let's just hope an extra week and not putting his body through that stress will do the trick. But Rublev has had I don't want to do his achievement down of winning that title, but he's had a really fortuitous run to the final in terms of players that were just short of full fitness. But then he's played Lorenzo Sonego, who's in the form of his life, and he's absolutely routined him, isn't he? You know, 6-4, 6-4.
Well, yeah, because the other player that Rublev played on that route was Kevin Anderson, and he also retired in the second set against Rublev. So he played three injured opponents in a row. But, you know, that does kind of demonstrate how impressive Rublev's own fitness and stamina to just keep pushing through this season has been. You know, he's not been hit with injuries so far, and fingers crossed he won't be. And yeah, I thought Sonego, kind of in the absolute form of his life, would potentially push Rublev more than he did. But in the end, Rublev won that fairly straightforwardly. And I don't think he lost serve in the whole tournament, Rublev. He's really backing up. He's not got a big serve, but it's kind of a solid serve. And he backs it up so well. And he's increasingly difficult to break.
Sonago, you mentioned, Matt. And
well done with that pronunciation,
yeah,
by the way.
We're committing to Sonago, aren't we?
We are, because Francesco Colucci got in touch again, Catherine. he said, "Dear friends, just seen Sonago Djokovic live. Unbelievable! Remember, it's Sonago, Sonago, not Sonego, okay?"
I do remember now. I remember very clearly. Thank you. It's important to shout these things at me, like Estrava. Sonego, Lorenzo Sonego in the quarterfinals in Vienna beat Novak Djokovic 6-2, 6-1. That is the heaviest loss that Novak Djokovic has suffered in his career over three sets. He's actually had, I believe, a heavier loss in a best of five set match against Marat Safin at the Australian Open at the very, very start of his career.
First time I ever saw Djokovic, that was. I commentated on that match.
I think that might have been his first ever Grand Slam match.
I think it
was,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to go back and, just sort of extract your thoughts about Novak Djokovic after that one.
I remember it vividly.
Match. Oh, you did? Of course you did.
Yeah, yeah. I remember it very well because, yeah, I mean, I'd never heard of Djokovic. I suppose I'd heard a little bit of the hype that goes around, you know, about a young player coming along and making the debut. And it was one of those where he was playing lovely rallies against Safin in terms of ball striking, but it was like they're playing a different sport in terms of man against boy. That's what it looked like. Because you know what Safin's like. I mean, he was a huge, muscular guy out there, and he was just manhandling Djokovic. But you could also see that Djokovic was absolutely loving every minute of it. Even though he got absolutely hammered, by the end of it, he was laughing at how good Safin was, and I remember them laughing together at the net after the match, you know, because he was just playing a different sport to the guy, because he's used to junior tennis. But it wasn't that long afterwards that I remember Djokovic playing as part of the Serbia team that faced Britain in the Davis Cup, and I think Djokovic, not much older, beat Rzeczki and, you know, really looked the part. And Serbia beat Britain in that Davis Cup tie, I think only a year later.
Nothing like Greg to bring out the best in people. That's certainly been my experience over the years. So, I mean, that wasn't, fast forwarding 15 years, that wasn't the story against Sonego, was it? I mean, you're absolutely right. Sonego did play the week of his life and has certainly shown something talent and ability-wise that I hadn't seen before from him, particularly in his semi-final against Dan Evans, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But in terms of the Djokovic victory, which is undoubtedly the moment of Sonego's career, I mean, what an achievement to extract the heaviest ever defeat from Novak Djokovic. But Djokovic had secured the year-end number one ranking in his previous match for the sixth time, record-equaling sixth time in his career. We mentioned that on our questions pod last Thursday. And towards the end of his loss to Sonego, the effort levels looked, I think, substandard to all of our eyes. Now, a lot of that was due to the great play of Sonego, but certainly it wasn't the defiant Novak Djokovic that we're used to seeing. And these were some of the quotes from him after the match. He said, "He just blew me off the court, that's all. He was better in every segment of the game. It was a pretty bad match from my side, but amazing from his side. He definitely deserved this result. I came here with the intention to try to earn more points and secure the world number one at the end of the year. I'm happy. I'm pleased that I'm healthy. And hopefully I can have a strong finish in London. I've done what I needed to do and why I came here. I move on completely fine with today's result and looking to the next chapter." Poor Lorenzo Sonego. Hearing those quotes, I hope it doesn't detract in his mind from his brilliant moment. I'm pretty torn about those quotes personally, because I enjoy the honesty, because we all know that sort of thing does happen. Had he not said those things, we all probably would have speculated that was the case anyway. But there is sort of an unwritten rule, isn't there? There's a code. So, and that's kind of there for a reason. So I don't know. I feel a bit conflicted about it.
I don't really feel for Sonigo, partly because he has given him lots of credit in the first part of those quotes. And I think Sonigo knows enough, really, to know that he wasn't playing full throttle Novak Djokovic. He's not an idiot. And he did play brilliantly. But, I mean, there are two reasons that was so one-sided. And the other thing is, I feel a bit for the tournament that is a really good tournament. It's an ATP 500, and you know it's kind of it in itself is slightly dismissed in those quotes in terms of its importance. I always feel for an event like that in that regard, but at the same time, it's not unusual at all, both for a player to feel like Djokovic did that day and to kind of say it. I mean, So it's probably more unusual this year because there isn't any reason to be burnt out physically and mentally in quite the same way. I mean, mentally maybe, because obviously it's got its own stresses, hasn't it, this year. But when you think back to all the years, I remember Djokovic, in fact, the year 2011, that he had that incredible 40-odd match winning streak at the start of the year. By the end of the year, I remember him being at the ATP Finals and he looked like a ghost, you know, in his press conferences because he'd had enough. And what the difference with him and say Nadal or probably Federer as well is Djokovic is really not good at hiding it, either on court or off court. I mean, sometimes off court he will because he is generous to an opponent, he always does try to say generous things. But you can see in his body language on the court whether he's in the moment or not. I've seen it so many times with him when he's not engaged. And, I mean, you know, it's not Nick Kyrgios levels of tanking, which is just totally disrespecting the moment and the sport and just trying to make out that he couldn't care less and kind of letting himself off the hook that way. Djokovic is just, I can't even pretend that I'm really, really into this. I will finish the match. I will put the balls in court, but you can have it because I just don't have it today.
The tell that he was trying less than 100% was how quickly he was playing. All the ball bouncing disappeared.
Let's just get this over with. You can have your win. You're the better player today. I don't have it within me to fight tooth and nail. So I will. He's almost setting him up for winners, to be quite honest, by the end.
Yeah, it had a Champions Tour feel about it.
And we have seen that with Djokovic reasonably recently. The only thing is we've not seen it this year. That's what I've been so surprised by with Djokovic this year, how he was talking at the start of the year, you know, with a bit of a glint in his eye about wanting to go unbeaten. That kind of language has not been used. I'm thinking of the 2018 and 2019 season where he was quite honest about his motivation coming and going and really trying to peak for the big events. And, you know, I kind of looked at his name in this draw at the start of the week and I just couldn't see past him as the potential winner because I knew he had this number one goal that he was aiming for. I didn't quite realise that he could get that goal so early in the tournament. In my mind, I kind of thought maybe he needed to reach the semis or final and that would sustain his motivation throughout the event. As it happened, it was obviously only needed to win one or two matches and therefore it kind of did feel like he was using the tournament for his own purpose rather than recognising the purpose he has for that tournament as well. I think that was the problem I maybe had with some of those quotes. But I think in the context of Djokovic's last few years, this kind of performance wasn't completely out of the ordinary. We've seen some slightly weird results. I remember that final against Karen Khachanov in Paris, where clearly he wasn't quite himself. I remember him playing Alexander Zverev at the ATP Finals, and he wasn't quite himself. He's had these slightly strange performances at the end of a season, but I just didn't expect it this year when he's been so motivated for every single tournament. It felt like something had just slightly changed this week. And I don't know, I think it's possible there were also lingering effects of that French Open final. That was that was the last time we saw him play. That was a heavy, bruising defeat he took. And his ability to recover and bounce back is extraordinary. But I can imagine that left a few little scars as well. He just wasn't quite himself in Vienna.
That was Matt Roberts' day, wasn't it? The pod where we reviewed Khachanov's Paris victory.
Yeah.
We all christened Matt Roberts.
David did.
Appearance on the podcast by going very big on Karen Khachanov.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Don't go back and listen in the archives. It hasn't aged brilliantly. So Djokovic, year-end number one, a sixth time. It's record-equaling with Pete Sampras, who did it 6 years in a row. There are two points of debate here. The first is how much of an asterisk will there be over this year? If it ends up tied, do we consider Novak Djokovic's record as in reality equal to Pete Sampras's because this has been such a curtailed year?
I would say I don't consider it equal if it all ends here. For both of those reasons, one is because of the year we've had. I know it seems a bit harsh to Djokovic, but I do feel that it isn't the same when you haven't had a full year. And the other one is just the fact that Sampras has done it 6 years in a row. I remember being around covering the sport back then. And that was the second debate topic, David.
Hold your horses.
All right, sorry.
I'm talking about the asterisk over this year.
Yeah, I would say if you're looking, I mean, there is a clear difference between the two for me because of the year that we've had.
I think there's an asterisk because not because of the fact that the year's shorter, actually. I think there's been enough tennis this year to determine a clear number one, and that is Djokovic. The problem is that the actual mechanics of the ranking system have been changed, and Djokovic is being rewarded, I think, fairly in the circumstances, but kind of unfairly if we're looking at it historically. He's being rewarded for what he achieved last year. You know, so many of his points that are on his ranking now are actually the points he earned last year. So it's a completely different way of measuring the ranking. So for me, that's the reason it has an asterisk next to it. It's not to diminish his achievements this year, but it's just a fact of the way it's changed.
And the way the rankings have changed have determined things, have determined decisions as well. Djokovic not playing Paris this week, because he can't gain anything in the rankings. You know, it's behavioural economics, isn't it, of a sort. Of course Djokovic fans will disagree, but I think logically, reasonably, there is an asterisk. I think the size of that asterisk will be different in people's minds. I think in Djokovic's mind, the asterisk will be pretty small. However, I do think he'll be very motivated to get number seven and make sure that whatever asterisk there is becomes irrelevant. Now, the second debate topic, which you've given the game away, David, is whether it is a greater achievement to do it 6 years in a row, which I think most people kind of reflexively would agree with. I saw Greg Rosedsky tweeting about that. I think, well, I won't give the game away about how you feel, David, but I think the default is to think, my God, 6 years in a row, that's extraordinary. And of course it is. But there is an argument that it is just as extraordinary, if not more so, to have done it over such a broad period of time, to have that longevity at the top, and not just the longevity, the bounce back ability, the resilience to drop off, to lose out to your rivals 1 year or the next year, and then to come back and peak again as the world's best. There certainly is an argument for that. Discuss.
I bet Ian Dowie feels great about getting one of his made up phrases from.
Oh, I hate myself. Don't dwell on it.
Bounce back ability is in the podcast all those years later.
Is it too late to edit it out?
No. That's it's a beautifully put phrase. But the thing is, it is also one that works. So, look, I absolutely, you can argue this either way, because when you put, I mean, I've always thought the 6 years in a row is the record in this particular conversation that differentiates Sampras from all the others. The others haven't done it. Several of them have done it 4 or 5 years in a row, and he did 6. That was. I remember what it took for him to do that, and I'll run through that in a minute. But just in terms of
David's not missing an opportunity to talk about Pete Sampras in depth,
you're right,
is he?
You're right. But when Matt raised it, that arguably there is definitely an argument for it being more impressive to have done it over such a span of time, to have come along 9 years ago and been number one, and then done it again in 2020. I mean, particularly when with the people you've got around and the age you're talking about, a guy in his early 20s and then a guy in his early 30s. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an argument for that. For me, I just, given that he's done it 6 years in a row and he's fought off Agassi and he's fought off Curtin for several years and all those players that Sampras managed to keep at bay in order to just always have the number one next to his name. I don't know how he did it in 1995 when Agassi just had the most astonishing year, it seemed, at the time. But yeah, I would go for that.
Matt?
Hmm.
This is the opening edition of Matt versus David for Monday, November the 2nd, by the way, because at 5:30 p.m. it is Fulham against West Brom. So yeah, I'm just setting the scene for tension.
Doing a morning recording so that we can watch it.
I don't know about David. I'm struggling to feel that much tension or rivalry with David and West Brom. I don't know whether
I am.
Okay, fine. I was thinking I kind of pity West Brom in the same way I pity Fulham this season.
If you're not playing us, I'm cheering for you. But,
okay,
you know.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, if you could dial up the aggro a bit, Matt, just for my sake later, that would be appreciated.
Today I can't stand you, Matt.
I'm not responsible for my actions between 5:30 and 7:30 on WhatsApp when the match is going on. But while it's not happening, I'm not feeling that usual tension. Anyway, I think by getting it this year, Djokovic has equaled Nadal. It's something Nadal has already achieved in terms of span between finishing the year number one. Nadal did it in 2008 and 2017. I think the reason why I would slightly give the edge in my mind to Djokovic is just that this idea of finishing it 6 years in a row, I think the reason that comes across as so great is it comes across as really dominant for 6 years. And I just don't think Djokovic's got loads of other things which point to his dominance over a 5-6 year span. And I don't think sort of necessarily finishing the year as number one is the determining factor for that for Djokovic. I think because he's got dominance elsewhere in terms of titles that he's won. So I think players maybe put more of an emphasis on finishing the year as number one than I do in my mind. It doesn't, for me,
it's a bit arbitrary, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Whether you're number one in February or December, I don't really mind. It doesn't make that much of a difference to me. I just think in terms of overall weeks of number one and the fact that you can still be number one when you're such a different player and person than you were 9-10 years ago, for me, that is completely incredible.
That's a very crafty move, Matt, to just, you know, take the debate off the table altogether.
Well, I feel like I'm swayed by the fact that I heard Sampras talk about this record with such reverence at the time and ever since. It's the one he valued it the most at the time, but he certainly values it now, I think, because it's the one that remains and the one that has never been broken. But you know, I remember what went into it, and I remember it at the time, but I've looked up a little just to remind myself. And I mean, listen to this. This is what he said at the time.
This is what David does at 3 a.m.
Yeah, I did.
reminisces with himself about the 90s.
On the eve of... This is preparation for the podcast, Catherine Mitchell, I'll have you know.
Yeah.
On the eve of the 1998 ATP World Tour Finals, which was called the World Championships in Hanover in 1998, he said, "It's rare that you have in your hands a record that you can maybe break forever." I know, and he, at the time, he was vying for world number one at the end of the year with Marcelo Rios, who had had the most fantastic start to the year, although he hadn't won a slam. He'd been in the final of the Australian Open. He'd won both Indian Wells and Miami, and in the most spellbinding way, and Rome. He was he barely lost a couple of sets in all three tournaments combined, but he couldn't bring it at the slams he lost at the French Open. Sampras had had a pretty ropey year. It's extraordinary that he managed to be in this position, because he'd lost in the quarters of the Australian Open. He'd lost in the second round of Indian Wells, Miami, Monte Carlo, French Open, Queens, and he made the semis at the US Open. Really, the fact that he won Wimbledon is really what kept this chance alive for him, and he beat Goran Ivanisevic in a match that he probably should have lost that as well. So this was not vintage Pete Sampras at all. He wasn't playing that well, and yet he was managing to just about keep in the hunt. He then went into a run of tournaments after the US Open, after he lost in the semis. He played 6 weeks in a row after the US Open to try to get to number one at the end of the year.
Did he enter Sofia qualifying?
It didn't exist. He entered all the equivalents. He entered Lyon. The only one he won was Vienna. He played Paris, and he lost in the final in Paris to Greg Rozetsky, which I know has never been something that sat particularly well with him. But he played everything that there was. He was going to tournaments and he was miserable. He was absolutely miserable because, I mean, you remember what he was like on the Champions Tour when he played in London that year, Catherine. He was, at the end of it, he was looking up the prices of private jets to fly directly to Los Angeles just to get home quicker.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to be away from home anymore. He got stressed out by it. And here he was, 6 out of 7 weeks playing 7 out of 8 weeks playing tournaments in Europe in cold weather.
Was this when he had the beard?
This is when he had a goatee.
Yes.
I looked it up. If you look at the photo of him standing next to Greg Rozetsky at the net in this Paris final, he's got a goatee.
Mm.
And it really doesn't suit him at all.
Mm.
But that's what tennis players do. They get some sort of sad facial hair that they really wouldn't have had if they were happier at times of stress like this. And so he goes into this tournament at the ATP Finals, and what they used to do back then, rather than the press conference at the start of the tournament, they would have these round table interviews. They'd just literally put a table for the 8 players, one each, and journalists, and they'd sit them down for basically however long, and journalists would just come and go. And this was the only story of the tournament. And I looked it up, this press conference transcript. He had to answer 79 questions over the course of this round table press conference interviews, and very often journalists were coming and going, not having known that he's already answered the same question about 4 times, and they'd come at the end having spoken to somebody else and they'd ask him again about the importance of number one. And he said, I note the importance of this week, I know the importance of this record, but in the whole grand scheme of things, the Grand Slam record is something that I put above everything. At that point he was on 11 Grand Slams, so he would win 3 more in his career to break the record of Roy Emerson. He was only one behind Roy Emerson at that time. And he broke Roy Emerson's record eventually and set the record of 14. As much as the ranking is important this week, winning the Grand Slam record is something that will be above and beyond anything I could ever do in the game. Bear in mind, he held that record for 9 years before Federer passed him. Then Nadal passed him, then Djokovic passed him. So that, I think that's another reason why I look at his holding this record of 6 in a row, end of year, as being so important, because Sampras was my favourite player before I worked in tennis. He was the one I kind of idolised. And I don't like the thought of him not holding a really significant record, you know, and having lost them all. Incidentally, Rios.
But he hasn't lost it. No one's arguing that he's lost that record.
But I think that's why one of the reasons I put such stock in it as well, as being an important record, is because I want it to mean a lot as well, for him to be remembered for something that nobody else has got, and for it to be a big deal. Incidentally, Rios only played one match in those ATP finals, his first one. He lost to Tim Henman, who ended up going to the semis.
And then thought,
he got injured.
Oh, forget it.
He got injured. He basically did, yeah. and Sampras discovered that he'd sealed the year-end ranking for a 6th time in his own hotel room while eating pasta on his own, watching
Which
Marcelo
feels really
Rios.
Pete Sampras to me. in my limited experience of him.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And he wouldn't dispute that. He said, you know, his view was, look, I'm a low key bloke. I want to be a winner. I love competing and winning, but he didn't like the fuss a lot of the time. He ended up being beaten by Alex Krejcik in the semi-finals, 7-6 in the third. And that year, he actually only won. Bear in mind that we're talking about Rublev having won 5 tournaments out of 12. Sampras won 4 out of 22 that year and finished world number one. Obviously, one of those was Wimbledon. But still, it's interesting to note the type of year everybody was having.
I just can't get over the 79 questions.
Yeah.
I can't get over David counting the 79 questions.
Well, I'm just looking through and I'm thinking, am I reading this wrong? It felt like I was just reading the same press conference over and over again as I'm scrolling down, and I thought, I wonder how many questions have actually been asked here.
Someone should show that transcript to Alexander Zverev.
Yes, that was my exact thought. Did he say, can't you just check the transcript?
And to be fair, he did handle it all with remarkably good grace, I would say.
David, when I was planning the time distribution of this podcast today, no one mentioned to me that there would be a sort of 18-minute Sampras soliloquy in the middle of it. So I'm afraid I'm going to punish Solihull as a result and take a bit of time away from our Dan Evans chat. He reached the semi-finals. Well, he's having a heck of a year. He's now joint third with Tsitsipas on the list of top 20 wins for 2020. He's got 8 of them. He's behind only Thiem and Djokovic. This is somebody that he still has a ceiling, Dan Evans, for me. When he takes to the court against those very, very top players, I rarely think, oh, he's got a chance here for an upset. The real top players, I mean, but he's so raised his own ceiling and is consistently achieving it. He beats the players that he is expected to beat now.
I think the players he's expected to beat, or he expects himself to beat, perhaps, has sort of nudged up in the rankings this year. I remember we've talked about our chat on the train back from Dorwich last year, Catherine, where we literally went through Dan Evans's entire season saying whether it was a good win or not. And we didn't find that many that we thought were really good wins, but he's had so many this year. He's made that jump. I think he's been slightly unlucky in the slams to play the type of player he's played, ones that cause him trouble in terms of a Mute and a Nishioka, guys who don't really struggle with his slice too much, I think, is the big sort of similarity between those players. I think when he plays someone who's tall and has big weapons, he can really neutralise them. And if he could play that type of player a bit more in the slams, that might help him. That's his next step, I suppose. There's potentially a little concern over his ability to close sometimes. You know, we've talked about him not winning from match point up on a couple of occasions. In Vienna, he played Sonego, who was, as I said, playing brilliantly. But you would take that in a 500 in the semi-finals, and he couldn't quite get past him. He's one of the highest-ranked players now without a title.
Although he was injured in that match, I think.
He had a bit of a left shoulder injury, didn't he? Which was a shame. But yeah, I mean, just really good strides for Dan Evans this year. And actually, just to say on Evans and Sonego, there was a small quirk in this tournament that Sonego actually lost in qualifying to Aliash Bedenay. And then Dan Evans beat Bedenay in the main draw. Sonego was in as a lucky loser, and then he beat Dan Evans. So it was like a little triangle where they could all beat each other. It felt like we've been talking about all the other Italians, and then suddenly Sonego is on the scene. And I don't know, I felt bad that he wasn't massively registering. He was a sort of flickering light in terms of these Italians coming through. But then I looked up that he'd lost 10 matches in a row on hard courts coming into this tournament. So it did kind of come from nowhere. And he had the shot of the year, which is the drop shot. He was using it incredibly well. And he's got a big forehand and a big serve. And I'm interested to see where he can take this now. But I didn't feel quite so bad that he wasn't on my radar when I read that record.
Can we agree that the drop shot is the shot of the year, David, if we can't agree on the men's player of the year?
Yeah, I think it's the one that has kind of come to the front of our minds when you're watching tennis matches more than it has in recent years. Yeah, it's the one that stands out to me. Yeah. Mm.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
So that's Vienna, done and dusted. Rublev champion once again. We also had an ATP 250 event taking place last week, the Astana Open in Nur Sultan. If you're confused, so was I throughout the whole week. Apparently, Nur Sultan and Astana are the same place, the capital of Kazakhstan. But whilst it was previously called Astana, it has been recently renamed in honour of a past leader of the country who presumably was called Nur Sultan. So that's
happened.
Yes,
he was, just without the hyphen.
Without the hyphen. So why have they put the hyphen in?
Past.
Not sure. Not sure. Okay. Well, let's just hope that you're not listening to this podcast in a future time where the capital of the District of Columbia is called Donald hyphen Trump. Or maybe that would be a good thing because it would mean he's out of office.
I think it would be Don hyphen Ald.
What?
Because Nur Sultan was the first name.
Oh, right. Don hyphen Ald. I mean, maybe that would be a really great tribute. Do vote, everyone, if you're in the States. So Nur Sultan, John Millman, on the boat, John Millman, he's won the title. He beat Adrian Mannarino 7-5, 6-1 in the final. The average rally length in that final was 9 shots, just a total war of attrition. Mannarino 0-6 on break points. It's a first ever tour title for John Millman, while Adrian Mannarino is 1-9 in ATP finals. I commentated on one of those finals, I was remembering, against David Goffin in Tokyo a few years ago, and I remember it being exhausting. Just, it was like a game of ping pong. It was utterly exhausting.
If the drop shot is the shot of the year, then somebody didn't tell these two, because there weren't too many of them in this match. I watched the last half dozen games of the match, and yeah, it was the same rally over and over again. I mean, incredible consistency, and Milman just seems to just get such a joy out of playing these rallies. And come on then. I'm going to keep going like this. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep going cross court until you lose your mind. And that's basically what ended up happening. And he's such a workhorse, isn't he, Milman? When we think back to, it was April, wasn't it, when we had him on the podcast, and he was explaining what lockdown life is like in Australia and not being able to play and all that sort of thing. And he just seems to have played everything since tennis has returned. And here he is in Kazakhstan, and you know, in his on-court interview afterwards, he was so warm about the way the tournament had managed to put itself on at such short notice and done such a good job. And he's saying, I definitely would want to come back here. And you know, it was just a really nice scene seeing someone like him holding a trophy really on the ATP tour for the first time. I mean, just one of those good guys. I mean, There's often something with Mannarino that's awkward watching him play. I mean, he's an awkward player to watch. He's actually a really effective player with the way he strikes the ball.
I don't think he would be offended by that,
no,
David. He prides himself on that.
I mean, on match points, there was an overruled call, and Milman comes to the net, arms in the air, celebrating victory. Mannarino's just stood there on the baseline, just looking at the umpire, because what's happened is they've called the ball in that was previously out, and he's saying, well, the call distracted me, so it should be replayed. And you've got this, and obviously you don't have a facility to replay that element of it in order to find out. So you've just got Mannarino stood there on the baseline, and Milman's there, well, are you going to accept that I've won, or have I, you know, how long are we going to stand here for? And eventually Mannarino came forward and accepted it, but a bit awkward at the end. But I don't know, I try to be fair and objective in these matches, but I'm really chuffed for John Milman that he's won a title.
And I think there was a kind of outpouring of goodwill towards him when he won that title. He's a guy that I think a lot of players on the tour get on with and kind of root for a little bit as well. And you mentioned him playing everything. I suppose he's had to play everything. You know, he's made that commitment to come over from Australia. It's not like he can go back. He's not got a base, I don't think, in Europe that he can sort of rest for a week and then go off to another tournament. He's just been, yeah, as you said, kind of grinding now for 2 or 3 months, going from tournament to tournament. It's nice that he's been rewarded with a title. I actually watched him play Tommy Paul earlier on in the week, just the end of that match, and he saved 2 match points there, John Milman. And I think he's the fourth or fifth player this season to win a title, having saved match point en route. Obviously, Ugo Humbert did it the other week. And Tommy Paul was also 5-love up in the deciding set tiebreak against John Milman, and somehow Milman managed to win it. Well, I say somehow, it was a massive choke from Tommy Paul. Unfortunately, he couldn't find the court with his forehand. But yeah, there's a lot of goodwill, I think, towards John Milman, and he's the kind of guy who at least deserves one ATP title in this career he's put together for himself since he, you know, since he stepped away from the sport and has come back.
Do you know, he won less money for winning that title than a first round loser got in Vienna. He got $13,000 just over for winning that title, did Milman. And the way they're weighting things these days, I mean, the first round prize money was $5,000, and so he only got $8,000 more for winning the whole thing. But in Vienna, €18,000 for a first round loss.
Wow. Goodness me. Yeah, that's a bit of a reality check for how things are at the moment. Yeah, I mean, just he's not, I mean, I'm sure the money's nice, but I doubt he'd have even looked at the check to see how much was on it, John Milman. I mean, a first ATP title for him, it's wonderful, really. It's a really great story. So that wraps up the tennis for the week. No WTA tennis last week, none this week either. There's just Linz remaining. That starts a week today as we record. So next Monday, the 9th of November, that'll be the final event of the year on the WTA Tour. There's Paris this week on the ATP Tour. That's just getting underway. Fucsovics and Čorić are on my screen at the moment. I've got the draw in front of me here just to pick out some highlights. Nadal, of course, is the top seed. He surprised us all by telling us that he's playing the tournament. Tsitsipas, the second seed. Then it's Medvedev, and Zverev is the fourth seed. Now, we haven't heard from Alexander Zverev since he released that statement last week in response to allegations of domestic abuse from his former girlfriend, Olya Sharapova. He wasn't put up for pre-tournament interview by the ATP over the weekend, as you perhaps might have expected, for the number four seed. He's got a bye in the first round. He'll play either John Millman or Misha Kecmanovic in the second round, and he would be required to come to press after that. We do understand that Olya Sharapova has done an interview with Ben Rothenberg for the New York Times. As we record at the moment, that hasn't come out yet. But of course, as and when it does, we'll cover it. We're certainly not sweeping the story under the carpet or moving on from it in any way. It's very much present in our minds. We're just conscious that there's been no further news. So we kind of are where we are with it, and we'll keep you posted on it all. There has just, I suppose, a very minor development in it is that Daria Gavrilova, the Australian player, of course, famous for her 2-week lockdown in 2-week quarantine in Perth after returning from her time in Europe, she tweeted a few days ago, very bravely, I think, to stick her head above the parapet like this. I don't know any other notable players that have done so. She says, good on Olya for opening up. It would have been pretty scary. I just hope that she can handle all the negativity and what's to come next. Hashtag I believe Olya. Hashtag why I stayed. Hashtag stop violence against women. So that's where we are with that. In terms of the tennis in Paris, we've got Evans against Wawrinka. That's probably the pick of the matches, would you say?
Yeah, it does stick out, doesn't it? I think they played a few weeks ago, and Evans had match points and didn't end up winning. So Wawrinka managed to, and that's happened before between those two, of course, at the US Open. So yeah, now it was interesting when Evans played Dimitrov the other day. I mean, the total opposite of a match like Millman against Mannarino. Incidentally, Mannarino, great stats put up by Nick Lester. That four of the rallies, longest rallies of the tournaments, 45, 46, 48 shots all involved Mannarino last week. But Dimitrov-Evans was just one of those matches that every single point you can concentrate on and see something a little bit different. You don't know what's coming next. Lovely sort of stylish match, or every shot in the book.
And we're expecting the same from Wawrinka-Evans? Is that the...
I would think so, yeah. I mean, it just works, doesn't it? Mm. The way they go about their lines of attack, they're not all the same.
Mm. So that's Paris starting today. Coverage in the UK is on Amazon Prime. A few other bits and bobs of news from the week. Simona Halep, very unfortunately, has announced that she's tested positive for COVID-19. She said, I'm self-isolating at home and I'm recovering well from mild symptoms. I feel good. We will get through this together. So we really wish Simona Halep well. It's another, you know, just sort of reality check of where we are with this pandemic. And we are in the UK or in England heading into another lockdown from Thursday, slightly less strict than the first one, but still pretty strict. It's going to, you know, inhibit all of our lives. I think the only significant difference is that elite sport will continue. And certainly for us personally, that's a huge relief that we'll still get to watch Fulham and West Brom lose, Reading win, And the ATP finals at the O2 Arena will go ahead, albeit with a massive testing process in place and significant sort of restrictions and bubbles and so on in place as well. Magdalena Rybakova, the former Wimbledon semi-finalist, is retiring. She announced this week. I mean, we talked about Yulia Gerges, didn't we, last week? And this is kind of what we expected, didn't we? You put it really well last week, David, didn't you, about how this kind of a year would make people reevaluate and reassess and really face up to how committed they are to just wanting to play tennis in any way, shape or form in the current circumstances. And it's not for everyone, and that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, and different players will have different levels of severity of injury that they might have been nursing, or have a kind of idea of what was required to get back and be able to play again. But I do think that it is giving pause for thought for players in a way that it wouldn't have done without the pandemic, for sure.
Simon Briggs has done a big interview with Iga Świątek, the French Open champion, for The Telegraph. What did we learn about Iga Świątek from this interview?
Well, it's just a lovely chat, really, that Simon has had both with her and several members of her team, and also Nick Brown, who's the British, former British player and coach, who was an early guide for Iga Świątek and acts as a mentor for her now, and also players from Poland as well, just to get a rounded view of what she is like, what her life is becoming now as a Grand Slam champion, and what it's going to perhaps be like in the future. I mean, she just comes across, unsurprisingly, I think, for those of us now who watched her at the French Open, heard her interview, she just comes across as such an engaging person and as an interesting, rounded, multifaceted person in general, and her interest levels. I mean, she said she went back to Poland after the victory and started reading up on all the politics there and really just wanting to understand the world that much more. That's the sort of person she is. I mean, she really doesn't sound as if she was absolutely 100% on being a tennis player until these most recent of months, where she's had this enormous success, and she's somebody with a lot of options in her life, and you still wouldn't be surprised at all for her to indulge herself in being able to follow different paths in life. But yeah, really good read anyway. Go and have a read of Simon's piece.
Just to wrap up a debate that we had last week, we're going to give Mary Carrillo the final say on it, because why wouldn't we? We were chatting to her this week about last week's debate about Hawkeye, and her views are thus. She says, I've never liked the challenge system, never bought the tactical use of stuff. What if a bad call goes unchallenged in the very first game and someone gets broken right away? Turning points happen all over matches, emboldening or unnecessarily pressurising players. The idea of being penalised for trying to make a call on the dead run from 80 feet away or incorrectly deciding not to, that's always been silly to me and unfairly burdens the players. But then again, I don't like on-court or illegal coaching either. She goes on to make a further point after some prodding from David on the specifics of her views. Mary, to confirm, ideally, would you have Hawkeye live and ditch line judges, or have line judges with Hawkeye as something that can just be invoked whenever needed? And there's, like Nur Sultan, David, there's a lot of rogue hyphens in that sentence. You've put a hyphen between line judges and a hyphen in Hawkeye. Anyway, we understood what you meant.
Well, I knew I was amongst the grammar police a week ago, so just
carry
on.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying it's just jumped out at me. Mary replied, in my perfect world, anything close gets an electronic look with no camera shame ISO on the lines person. Clearly, even before the threat of COVID, transporting, housing and feeding lines people was only getting more expensive, while technology will only get more affordable. I would take some of the off-match duty lines people and place them squarely in the players' boxes to keep coaches, parents and other shadily credentialed people from cheating. Who wouldn't want to see Maria Cichak happily sitting between Tsitsipas and Mouratoglou? In summation, fewer lines, people, more accuracy and consistency from technological calls. Cheechak's driving coach is crazy. Drama redirected.
Drama redirected.
I mean, it's a hell of an
very good.
It's a hell of an elevator pitch, that, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, oh.
Yeah.
I was quite confident in my position a week ago.
Yeah, so was I. Forget it all. Let's go back and delete last week's podcast. It feels irrelevant now.
Whatever Mary said, all right?
Yeah, what she said. So I have, I've given you the joy and the light that is Mary Carrillo there, because unfortunately I have to follow up with some incredibly sad, if not altogether unexpected news. But I'm not sure that takes away at all from the sadness, and certainly not for Steve and Joe, owners of Cam, our lovely French Open mascot, because Cam sadly passed away this week. Steve informed us via email, and it's desperately sad news. I know how overwhelmed and fortified Steve and Joe were by the outpouring of joy and love there has been for Cam over the past few weeks, and I'm sure they would appreciate feeling the same at what is a very, very sad time for them. Cam was quite clearly one of the most excellent dogs that ever lived. And I hope in time, when the sadness is lessened just a little, we'll be able to remember him happily and fondly. So I hope that cloak of warmth and togetherness that I described a few weeks ago is a small comfort to Steve and Joe at the moment. We're thinking of you guys, and it was our privilege to have Cam on the mascot team. So that's it for our first weekly podcast of this week. We'll be back on Thursday. What will we be doing on Thursday?
Just more questions.
A Pete Sampras show. Send in your questions about Pete Sampras.
Fine by me. By the way, if you haven't read Steve Flink's book on Pete Sampras, which I'm just reading on loop.
Probably don't need to
moment.
After today's podcast, David. You've
Greatness
gazumped him.
Revisited, if you'd like to have a look. Steve Flink's book on Amazon. So there you are.
We love to revisit things, don't we? And David loves Sampras. Yeah. So it's a coming together of all the best things. So we'll be back on Thursday answering more of your questions, and enjoy Paris. Enjoy watching Paris in the meantime. And yeah, I think that's it. Any more?
We got any shout outs, mate?
Ooh.
Yes. Sorry, I was slightly tuned
he was having out. He was having Sampras thoughts, David. He had disappeared into a world of Sampras.
We've decided to ditch Fulham against Albion and just have a chat for 2 hours about Sampras, and I can properly
I'm not
have
watching
an
Fulham against Albion on my own. That nobody should be subjected to that. Watch Reading Coventry on Friday, or Coventry Reading. That was bad enough. I have heard some people question whether this comes under the category of elite sport.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
You can make your own judgment when you watch it.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone listening is paying 15 quid to watch that. Right, shout outs, Matt.
There are ways. Shout outs to Matt Bernhardt.
Hello, Matt. Great name.
Hello, Matt.
Indeed. Although one T, but you know, still a great name.
Or like Matt's.
Yes, but without the S.
Without the S. An amalgam, if you will. Moving on, Matt.
With an apostrophe when required.
Hyphen. Oh, right, okay. I thought it was an apostrophe. I thought it was a hyphen gag, previous gags.
Good try. Carry on, Matt.
That tone of voice has riled me more than I can express in words.
Carry on, Matt.
How am I supposed to carry on? Shout out to Arvind.
Hello, Arvind. Is it Arvind
Hi,
Palmer?
Arvind.
It's just Arvind.
Well, it could be Arvind Palmer then.
It could
then.
Be.
Hello to all the Arvinds, just in case.
Who are backing us.
Yeah.
And to Maiken Kierkegaard Bricks.
Well, that's amazing.
Yes.
Can you say that again?
Maiken
Stitch up.
Kierkegaard Bricks.
Wow. Awesome names.
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks to you. Say it again, Matt.
I'm not going to say it just in case I get it wrong, because I don't want to.
Me either.
It would be doing a disservice to an excellent name if I were to do so. But thank you.
I've said it wrong twice, so there we go.
It was a valiant effort. It's a cracking name, and we are very grateful for your and everybody's support of the tennis podcast. I'm going to go and have a row with David off air, and we're going to be back on Thursday with another podcast. We will see you then. Goodbye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.